right, welcome to another episode of That Record Got Me. Hi, I'm your host, Rob Elba. Thank you all for stopping by. You know what we do every week? We invite a special guest. They choose a record they love, a record that got them high, and we dig in and discuss it. Groundbreaking, right? No, it's not really. But hopefully it's entertaining, right? If you're a regular listener, just know that I really appreciate you. I know there's a lot of music podcasts out there, and I really do my best to make these episodes fun, informative, and most importantly, not boring. If you're a patron of the show, I really appreciate you. And remember, if you'd like to become a supporter of my show, just head over to patreon.com/TRJMH. And for as little as $2 a month, you can become a patron, you receive our newsletter, participate in our bonus patron-curated episodes, etc., etc. My guest today is Rob Cassis. Is it Cassis or Cassis? I guess I should have asked him beforehand, but whatever. And guess what? He's the co-host of another goddamn music podcast. So there you go. The podcast is called 1001 Album Complaints, and each week a group of musicians and lifelong friends pick an album from the book 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die, and they discuss it. Another groundbreaking podcast, right? I was recently a guest on his show discussing Manic Street Preachers' The Holy Bible, which may actually be out by the time this episode drops. I think it's going to come out about the same time, so that's cool. So here is my conversation with another Rob discussing his album pick, Spoons Kill the Moonlight.
All good. I'll follow your lead. I got my notes here, but I'll go wherever you want
to
go.
I know you're note heavy, so I was thinking, well, whatever. He's going to have all the info anyway on this record. But
well, I don't know about all of it, but okay.
I mean, I really love this album, and I love Spoon, and I'm pretty sure I think I discovered them from this album, actually. So what's your was this your first time hearing Spoon with this record?
It was, yeah. This is how they came to me. Someone must have handed me a burned CD. I can't quite remember who it was. I was really trying to rack my brain to remember who exactly would have given it to me. I think around this time, meaning shortly after this record came out, they were on like a car commercial.
Yes.
The way We Get By was on a car commercial. So I kind of remember hearing that. And maybe that's what piqued my interest.
Yeah. And same with me. I can't quite remember, but this is the album. And then I said, man, these guys are good. And then I dove earlier and then later because they had already had, I think, their next album was out. And then I got Ga 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 Ga, which is also an awesome record. But yeah. I don't know. What is it? So what is it about them that sort of grabbed you? Because I know what grabbed me, but it's kind of hard to quantify in a way. But what is it that grabbed you?
Yeah, I was listening to it again this week, and it's definitely strongly wrapped up with my personal story, which I'd love to get into with you. But I think musically, it's this tight, economical version of rock music at a time when I felt like jaded indie rock was sort of taking over what modern music was. And so for me personally, it just hit me at a time where it reminded me that rock music was still this vital force. And it could be made in, you know, with guitars in a sort of traditional setting, still have all these great little production touches, but also feel primal and also be kind of groovy and funky in its way.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great description. And yeah, I feel like that happens to me every couple of years because I'll start to get down on music and think, there's nothing good to hear anymore. And then I'll hear something like this. The thing about it is, it's funny. So this was their fourth album already. It came out in August 2002. So it's the rare instance of a band, like when they enter their, you know, using the studio as an instrument phase. You know, when bands get in that way.
Yeah.
But it's like, instead of making it overproduced, they went in the opposite direction of overproduction, you know? And it's all really stark. But it's so effective because it creates this attention, like the starkness of it and the way they use, you know, just these little sounds and effects. But it's so quiet in between them that when they do come in, it just hits that much harder.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely got this post-punk aesthetic with lots of breathing room in the arrangements. And I think they were definitely inspired, right, by bands like Gang of Four and Elvis Costello.
And smart young woman on a light blue screen who comes in. Takes
stuff from that kind of late 70s, early 80s era. But at the same time, like you said, there's a lot of subtlety. And I get the impression that this band was also, they were experimenting with production touches of the type you're talking about and expanding their sonic palette, adding things like piano and synthesizers, and just being a little more open to non-obvious rock and roll choices.
Right. Yeah, and also at the end, behind everything else, the songs are really good. Britt Daniels, like a great songwriter, but it's almost like, you know how when you eat it, like some chefs will do a deconstructed, like this is a deconstructed Greek salad. I feel like these are deconstructed songs. You know, they sort of take these songs and sort of deconstruct them.
Absolutely, and I think, yeah, that's the other thing I want to say about this, and at the time it hit me. So let me just tell you a little bit about my personal story with
I'm really excited to hear that because I'm like, what the hell is he talking about? But go ahead.
I discovered it just around the time that I left home for good after college. And I drove across the country with my best friend to live in San Francisco. And to be honest, I didn't really have a plan. I just wanted to get as far away from my hometown as possible. And I decided on San Francisco. I had only visited once briefly, threw everything in my car. And that would have been the summer of 2003, so the summer after this came out. But I had a copy of this record, and I remember us blasting this on the drive. And one of the things I was thinking about when I was heading out to the big city in my mind across the country was that I wanted to start a band. You know, I had played music for a while at that point. I had been in some bands with my friends, but I had never lived in a city, a proper city. And so I was like, I'm going to get there, I'm going to start a band, it's going to be like a real thing, and we'll have all these places to play, because it's not just a college town anymore. So I'm bringing it up because it was inspiring to me, Kill the Moonlight, that is. It was inspiring to me because it was all those things we already said, all those positive attributes about songwriting and production and being economical and leaving space, but it also felt achievable. It felt like something I could write and perform. In this really cool way. It just felt like the top level of what that was. So I was like, oh yeah, this is what I want to be. This is kind of what I want my band to be like. I want us to be tight. I want us to be smart. And I want it to have this rock and roll energy, which I think Spoon really, really get across.
Yes, yes.
You know, the first song I wrote for that eventual band I formed was definitely me trying to do a Spoon thing. A poor imitation of Spoon, but I was 100% thinking of that.
Yeah. No, that's great. And that's totally valid. I think that's something, you know, you could say, oh, well, you're just trying to copy that. But it's like, no, you're inspired by something and I want to do a song like that. But it ends up, it's you doing it and it's going to come out different anyway. And you're going to end up, if you're any kind of, you know, artist and everything, it's going to end up putting your own spin on it anyway. But yeah, I think that's totally valid. And yeah, like, you were saying, that's the one thing right from the start, and the more I listen to them, I feel like Spoon, they have this kind of swagger to their delivery, which is very appealing. Yeah. And it's like, you know, when I listen to them, it feels like they're fully aware that they're just like a little bit cooler than other bands, other indie bands.
There's definitely a coolness factor. Yes, exactly. And I think this is me being reflective, you know, looking at it retrospectively. At my age now, but I would say that coolness, like you just implied, is a fake it till you make it kind of coolness. It's let's just pretend and let's just, confidence solves everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Swagger. It's just like a swagger.
You could hear that. Yeah. You could hear the braggadociousness in Britt's vocal. And I wanted to just like briefly go back to the thing about referencing other songs, even in your mind, when you yourself are writing and producing songs. It's something that I was a little more cautious about when I was first writing songs in my 20s or teens and 20s. But over time, I've really embraced it. I think it's a really smart move as a production technique.
Me too, same. Yeah.
To like nowadays, when I have a song, when I make a demo and I want to go arrange it with my band or we want to record it or produce it, I always make a playlist of touchstones, of things that even some small aspect of the song kind of remind me of or that I was thinking of in this part. You know, they might be genre disconnected or whatever, but I think it's very, I think it's silly to think that what you create does not have a predecessor. You're always standing on the shoulders of giants, of course.
Right. And one other thing before we get into the record and start listening to them, I'm just curious, did you, when you first heard them, did you think, because I totally thought they were a British band, that they were from the UK. I assumed, okay, these guys must be from England. And then I found out they were from Austin, Texas.
That's a good point. I definitely don't think I would have thought Texas. I'm not sure I gave it too much thought, but I definitely see how they could be a British band. They have that kind of tight, clipped approach
that reminds
me a bit of stuff coming out of Britain at the time. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or I think if I would have guessed, I might have said something like a more working class kind of city, like a Detroit, where the White Stripes are from, or you know, Minneapolis or something like that. But yeah, Texas seemed odd when I learned that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And just real quick before we get in there, I would say that them and also the Brian Jonestown Massacre can be credited with bringing the tambourine like to the forefront again for indie bands. they use that tambourine.
The tambourine in Brian Jonestown Massacre, I mean, that's like the whole show, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I remember watching that documentary. This must have been over 10 years ago now. I'm sure you saw it as well. Where they highlight, I think the guy's name is Joel, the tambourine player. It's like, this guy's the best guy. And he's the chillest dude in the band also.
Yep.
So you just kind of immediately like him better than the lead singer.
Yeah.
Wait, actually, sorry, Rob. Can we go back one second?
Yeah.
Because I just had a memory right now. I haven't thought about Brian Jonestown Massacre in a minute. But I have this very specific memory of after I watched that documentary and thinking, yeah, this band's really cool. I then went to Amoeba Records in San Francisco. One of three Amoeba Records in California. It's a great record store.
Yep.
It's in a place that used to be a bowling alley. It's like a huge, it's an amazing record store if you like used records.
Oh, it is.
And I was trying to sell some records back because that's one of the things they do. And Joel was the record buyer. So I had this experience.
Oh, wow.
Because he still worked there,
that's,
you know,
great.
And he's in this seemingly successful touring band called Brian Jonestown Massacre. They just had this documentary released about him, which got some artsy heat behind it. That's how I saw it, I reckon.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting there and he's staring me down and telling me why my taste, you know, sucks. He doesn't want to buy my record. So
that's totally on brand, right? Totally on brand.
Classic San Francisco hipster experience, you know.
For sure. All right. So let's listen to the first track, a little bit of Small Stakes.
Small stakes give you blues. If you don't feel taken, don't think you've been used. Cause it's alright Friday night to Sunday. It feels alright, keeps your mind on the page. I have small stakes and show you the Leatherman blues. But you don't feel taken and you don't feel abused. Small stakes tell you that there's nothing can do. Can't think big, can't think past one or two. And alright.
So great, right?
So great. Great foreplay.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. And it's so sparse. I mean, I love how they sort of get this percussion. It's like percussion out of nowhere. Like they just have this, I don't even know what that is, that beating thing. Is that an electronic thing or is that someone actually just beating their finger on something? It's like, I don't even know what it is, but it's so subtle.
Yeah,
right?
They're very good. They are a very rhythmic band, I think, you know, consistently through their catalog. And I think it's because this was produced, and most of the instrumentation is the lead singer / guitar player / piano player, Britt Daniel, right? And the songwriter with the drummer, Jim Eno.
Right, right.
And
right.
So I always think drums and rhythm are always a big part of it. And I think one of the things they do in this song really well is they create rhythm without drums.
Yeah, right?
That synth line has such a... That defines the rhythm of the song. They obviously add in that tambourine, but it never really kicks in. Your brain is like thinking it's going to kick into something much bigger.
Exactly.
You know, at one point there is like a drum roll, but it still doesn't really ever land on anything. Like there's this sense of tension that does not get released.
That's it. So, yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. And it's very appealing. That tension without release. I don't know. It's
absolutely.
That grabs you. And I can picture, I'm sure you driving through a new city, like you're listening and it's like, yeah, you hear this and how does it not? It just sort of, makes sure the hairs on you stand up like, oh shit, this is, it's cool and it's rock and roll, but it's totally different than, other types of rock and roll,
Yeah. And it's bold too. And I think that's one of the, I didn't know it at the time, right? But of course, after I listened to this, I went forward and backward in their career and listen to Girls Can Tell, which is the preceding record. And then when Gimme Fiction came out a couple years later, I think is when I finally got to see him live. But I now understand that this is a little bit experimental for them, right? Even though I think they believe now it's their best work. And so the fact that they start, I think of them as a guitar band, right? The lead singer has a guitar. There are a lot of guitars in their work. And yet they start the record off with a no guitar song. And then the second song also, I believe, does not have any guitar in it. That just feels very bold, like a very bold choice, ultimately successful choice.
Oh, yeah, real. Yeah, totally. Yeah, it totally is. And all right, so let's get into the second song. This song actually got a lot of, this is probably, like you said, the first song maybe me and you both heard by them. Let's listen to The Way We Get By.
We get high in back seats of cars. We break into mobile homes. We go to sleep to shake. That's the way we get by, so where we get by. All that's the way we get by, so where we get by. We go out in stormy weather, we rarely practice discern. We make love to some weird sin, we seek out the taciturn. And that's the way we get by, to the way we get by. All that, the way we get by, to the way we get by. Let's do the way we get by, to the way we get by, to the way. Let's do the way we get by, that's the way we get by. We found a new kind of dance in a magazine. Try it out, it's like nothing you ever seen.
Yeah, I was just listening, and that's exactly what you're talking about. The first third of the song, the rhythm is the piano, really. The piano is the rhythm of the song, and you just got that. The hand clap is the snare, and you got the tambourine, and then that's it.
Yeah, they're really good at withholding drums and other instruments as well. I don't think there's one strummed chord on this whole record.
Oh, right.
So everything,
right.
For that reason, feels really tight and rhythmic. It always makes me want to bob my head. But yeah, when they finally do kick in with a full drum kit, I mean, it rocks. This is just a great pop song. You're right.
It
was the first one I heard by them on some car commercial. I read, when I was researching to do this podcast, I read that it was on the OC, which was like a popular show at the time. I don't think I heard it there. Didn't watch that show.
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't watch the OC, but yeah, the OC and then Shameless, also a TV show, and also Stranger Than Fiction, the film Stranger Than Fiction had.
I do remember that, the Will Ferrell one, right?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But that must have come a little later. It's so funny, listening to this again this week and thinking back to when I discovered it and when it first hit me. It was really a struggle to try to remember how one discovered music back then.
Right.
And how, because I didn't have much money to buy CDs. And I later saw the cover and everything, but in my memory, I know I did not have an actual copy of the CD. So someone must have given it to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, but I think I heard this song on a commercial and thought, oh, that's really cool. And it felt like it was a time when indie rock was A, on the rise, but B, it was kind of starting to break into the mainstream. I seem to remember that like a Modest Mouse song was also in a commercial around that time. And
oh, gotta see, gotta know right now, what's that writing on your everything?
been maybe just a little bit before the Shins broke kind of big with Garden State and things right. like that. But, you know, I feel like advertisers were starting to tap into this cheaper pool of indie music and use it to come off as hip. And it worked.
Right. Now, at that time, were you aware that there's Iggy Pop, Iggy and the Stooges references? There's at least three in this song.
No, that came much later.
Right.
That came much later. Yeah.
I was wondering.
I did not know what Some Weird Sin was at the time.
That's when I want some weird sin. That's when I want some weird sin just to relax.
Right, right. And we go to sleep to Shake Appeal, he says, and then also Fall in Love to Down on the Street, which is Funhouse from Funhouse. So yeah, he's definitely throwing it in. We didn't mention the first song. He did a little shout out to the White Stripes and Harmar Superstar, which is a really deep cut there.
I love it when these guys wear their influences on their sleeves. You know, I have a funny Iggy Pop story that happened maybe a few years after I would have gotten into this, which I was on a road trip in Europe. It was my first time abroad, and we went to Europe and we rented a car. And I was driving some long distance, I don't know, between Amsterdam and Paris. And it was pre-streaming, and it was pre-smartphone. And so it was either listen to the radio, and we didn't bring our CDs with us, right? So we stopped at like a truck stop, and they had a very limited CD selection, but they had Iggy Pop's Lust for Life. And I bought that, and we just listened to it for like 5 hours straight. That's the one with Some Weird Sin on it. So.
Yep.
So that would enter my consciousness a few short years later. But.
Oh, yeah. Well, you could do much worse than getting the Lust for Life as the one CD to listen to. You could.
I agree.
Could have done a lot worse. all right. So something to look forward to. This is cool because I feel like the lyrics in this could sort of be a summation of the whole album as a whole, which we'll discuss. But let's listen to a little bit of Something to Look Forward To. So many things we could say, so many things we could let get out, but you stay in instead. Some things are better left unsaid. Give me something to look forward to. I feel like that's like the whole album because it's so, you know, it's so like he's so good at saying things without saying things, you know, and just not being overly wordy and obviously not overly throwing the instruments in too.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think of him as this amazing lyricist. But again, I think he's such a, I do think he's a good songwriter. And
oh,
I think he's able to, you know, take simple lyrical concepts and create a lot of mystery. So I guess that's what you're saying, like leaving gaps
yes.
in what he's saying.
Right.
Allowing for a lot of interpretation. I thought maybe you were alluding to this at the top, but that's something to look forward to because this whole album kind of has that intro to another song feel.
Oh,
they're
right,
always
right.
It always feels like it's building to something. And that's not a criticism. I do think it like pays off at various points, but it's so groovy, right? To me, this one in particular is like a very, I've come to think of it as a very prototypical Spoon song. It has so many elements that I think they go to quite frequently. They start with something that's not drums or bass. So in this case, I think it's some kind of acoustic guitar with really loose strings on it. I'm not really sure what that
oh, right.
is making that noise. But it gives me total stank face. Like it's real funky how it begins. And that bass tone, I think this is, you'll hear this on, definitely on Gimme Fiction, on I Turn My Camera On. Like you hear the echoes of a song like this on tracks like that.
I turn my camera on, I cut my fingers on the way.
It just feels like quintessential them. It rocks. Does it rock or does it groove? That's why I can't quite figure out. I think it confused me, and I think I liked holding those two ideas in my head.
When I was
22 years old, I was like, oh man, how can a band sort of accomplish so much with seemingly so little? Again, there's a lot of subtlety here.
There is, and that's the hard. To me, that's sometimes the hardest thing to do, because people do, especially when you're first starting out. You want to throw everything in there, and as soon as you want to use as much as you can. But that's the real genius sometimes, is knowing what to leave out and to leave the space in there. And sometimes that's what really works, you know. But sometimes that's the hardest thing to do.
Totally. Oh, you know, I wanted to point out a trope. It's certainly not owned by Spoon, but it's something I always go for, which is they talk about how Pixies pioneered the quiet, loud approach to songwriting.
Right.
I'm not even sure they really pioneered that. I think that's been around for a long time. I think you can hear that on Led Zeppelin recordings and things like that.
Yeah.
But there's another similar concept that I think is at play here and on some of these other songs for modern rock songwriting, which is they kind of, in the verse, it's not so much quiet as it is, it has a low frequency range. They're playing only two strings on the guitar, or they're just playing a bass drum, or, you know, they're kind of keeping it frequency range-wise really tight. And then in the chorus, it opens up, and he gets into that arpeggio and kind of, or you get into, like, these bigger, fully voiced chords. And it's just an interesting way without really, it's less about a shift in dynamics, and it's more about a shift in the amount of frequencies you hear.
But it creates
that similar change that I so it's just something I always really listen to in arrangements and really appreciate.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I get it. Because something, like I said, sometimes it's hard to quantify, but I think you just did it. You just quantified what the appealing thing is about a lot of everything. So good job with that. All right. So let's listen to the next tracks. Let's do a little bit of Stay Don't Go. Okay, so speaking to what you were saying before, just about when you think about the confidence and the bravery, you're a band, this is like your fourth record, you just moved out, you were on Matador and now you're on Merge Records, and you're deciding that the human beatbox thing is going to be the rhythm in this song, and
yeah.
You know, I mean, that takes, like what I was talking about, swagger, that just takes a certain amount of confidence and, you know, and believing in yourself to put something that strange, because you would think someone would say, well, that's just a placeholder, but we'll put real drums in there after, you know?
right. No, I totally agree with you, and I think when you first hear this, or when I first heard it, you're kind of like, oh, they're really going to make a whole song around this? Like, is this going to continue for 3.5 minutes? But it really works. And
it does.
I think Britt Daniel, I'm pretty sure he's the only voice on this thing. So that's got to be him doing the beatboxing and then him singing that sort of falsetto version of his voice, which I think originally I thought might have been a woman. But now I know that it's definitely him singing over top of it. Yeah, it's really, you know, so one of the things I think that makes them a great band is they're willing to pull from other genres fluidly. So we've already brought up funk, which is not, you know, doesn't have to be a part of rock. I think they also are very influenced by electronic music.
Oh, yeah.
And
for sure.
A lot of this stuff sounds, this is obviously a loop, the beatboxing thing, But to be honest, a lot of their stuff kind of sounds like it might have started as little loops. I noticed it in The Way We Get By and how the piano riff feels. It feels like it could have been a sample of itself, you know, after they played it. So, and I don't know. I just think there's something about that kind of quantized approach to music making, or maybe you could say it's pulled from hip hop, not EDM, but they seem very willing to pull in those influences.
Yeah, yeah. And they do it so good too. They're so effective at doing it, because it could also be done and just not work and not come off, and then it's just bad. But like you said, you're on board with it. You hear it and you go, oh, okay, it actually works. It's great.
Totally. And yeah. Then the other thing, you know, it's an example of some of the production touches, which are all throughout this record, if you start really digging in and listening. But that kind of reverse suck out
guitar
thing.
Yeah, that just comes in and then snaps off. Yeah.
It's almost like a sound effect.
Yes.
But there's a lot of little stuff like that. So yeah, really interesting the way they manipulate what they have and make it sound not traditional. And I would just say on the whole record feels like every inch of it was planned. Like they used every part of the Buffalo and they planned every moment.
Oh, right.
And yet,
right.
As I say that, it does not feel overproduced.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying at the beginning. That's what I said. Like, you know, use it, you know, use the studio as an instrument, but not over. Don't, you know, don't throw the kitchen sink in there. It's like it's so well done the way they do use the studio.
Such restraint, which yes. is a real rarity in art. Generally, certainly in rock music.
Oh God, yeah, right. All right, so Jonathan Fisk, supposedly about a school bully of Brits who later became a fan of the band. I don't know if you read anything about that, but let's listen to it and we'll talk. Jonathan Fisk. Oh.
Yeah, it's a rocker, man.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a little more of a straightforward rock song in my mind. It's got that 16th note downstroke thing that you associate with punk and post-punk music. I do like that he gets that little extra tonality of a saxophone in there
yeah,
on that chorus.
Right, right.
Makes it feel like the timbre, you know, kind of opens up a little bit in your ear, even though it's still downstrokes. And similar to my comment before, I think what you hear as a difference in what he's playing a different chord. But more importantly, in the verse, I think he's just kind of playing the top two notes of the guitar, or rather the bottom, the lowest two notes, like power chords. And then in the chorus, he kind of opens up and plays five or six strings. And, you know, that makes it feel like it opens up.
Right, right. Yeah, it does. And it's rare. I was just like paying attention. And it's like it's super simple. I mean, it's basically just the, you know, the bass in this one, the bass is basically just doing what the guitar does. And you can tell it's just one guitar. And yeah, it's just simple, but it's just it just works. It's great.
Yeah. Keep it simple, man. John, keep it simple, stupid. Jonathan it. Fisk speaks with his fist.
That's great. Did you read that at all? That's a guy who's supposedly based on.
No, I didn't. Bullying. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. And then he became a baby. Like for 2 years, he'd come to all their shows and stuff. So.
That's pretty rad.
It is rad. All right. So, you know, you're probably the same. Like, I love this album. I listened to it so much, but I hadn't listened to it in a while. So revisiting it was really fun. And this next one, Paper Tiger, for me, I think it's like the sleeper of the record because I didn't realize how great a song it was. Maybe not then, or I just didn't remember, but I really love this song. So let's do a little bit of Paper Tiger. Oh.
I'll never hold you back, and I won't force my will. I will no longer do the devil's wishes. Something I read on a dollar bill. A paper tiger can't tell you where he stands. We'll go back tonight the way that we came. I'm not dumb, just wanna hold your hands, alright. Where we want to be, alright. What thought we could be.
Yeah, man, it's so weird and so sparse, but I just really love this song.
I think it's maybe the production triumph on the record, and it also breaks their convention the most. So I do think it stands out for the reason you're saying. A couple nice notes to it, although I do think they made more stuff like this later. In fact, I think Gimme Fiction, the song Gimme Fiction opens with, reminds me a bit of this song, The Beast and Dragon.
Oh, okay, right.
Just in terms of how it's produced, not so much the feel.
Right.
But I just wanted to say that the stick click, not like you, when the when a stick click comes in to any song, you think that means the drums are about to start,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Because that's, but so it's a nice misdirect that
it
that is,
it's brilliant.
The drum part, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, we haven't mentioned Britt's, he's got this great rock and roll growl, obviously. He's got the scratchy voice thing, but he also has a really nice falsetto.
Yes.
And
yes,
I think it gets used, deployed very, in a very nice way on this song. He doesn't overuse it, you know, and when he does it here, it in the chorus, he has a little, I don't know if it's like a bell piano, a Celeste, or some other electric piano mirror the exact same melody line at the same time. It's a really nice touch.
It is. And also musically, I know you're a musician, I'm sure you notice this. You notice it changes, very subtly changes the figure, like the musical figure of it. It starts out, right? It starts out in the when they're playing the notes in like straight 4/4, and then it jumps a little, and then it's a little different, and then it gets a little different again, and it's subtle, but it's really,
oh, interesting,
effective.
Like they're moving through the measure, like,
yes,
where they start.
Right,
yeah,
right, right.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
And it's great. Yeah. And I just love, like you said, there's not many lyrics. They're very simple, but I'll never hold you back and I won't force my will. I will no longer do the devil's wishes, something I read on a dollar bill. That's just a great two lines, you know? They're just great. They're
great.
So simple, but they're great. Very effective.
No, I agree. And it's probably one of the better written songs, too. You know, I think that's maybe also why it stands out. The lyrics feel more crafted here. I just am so impressed with the restraint of this band and this whole, like, the fact that the drummer, because I know he's a great drummer, and there's some great drums on this record, that he's very egoless and willing to just go, you know what, stick clicks.
Yeah, right.
Tambourine.
Exactly, exactly. How many drummers do you know that you play with that would never put up with that? What are you fucking talking about?
I want you to play less.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Oh, I once told a drummer I didn't want him to use his cymbals in a song, and I swear he was going to cry.
I remember we went through a whole recording project, the whole album, where it was a challenge to work with the drummer to a certain extent, and I kept saying, like, I really think this song needs more floor tom. Can you put some more floor tom in there? I feel like that gives it a nice tribal feel. And then it was just like smash cut to me in the DAW looking at the floor tom mic, and it's just completely blank
of
the entire
course,
album.
Yeah. drums are the worst.
Yeah, exactly.
Cymbals. I should say cymbals are the worst, but the drummers are the ones, unfortunately, that hit them. So, you know,
guilt sure
by
do.
Association. All right. So let's get to the next song. Now we're done bashing drummers. Listen to a little bit of Someone Something.
So what's up then?
Yeah, right there, really nice drumming, but so, you know, he's perfectly playing just what the song needs and not anything more, you know, not anything
totally
more
agree. No, totally agree. And I think just to backpedal a little bit on crapping on drummers, I think the challenge, the curse and the blessing of being a drummer is that you don't really have to learn anyone's songs to play along. You kind of just have to know the meter it's in. You have to approximately know where the changes are happening. And so I think a lot of drummers and other players too who have the ability are sleepwalking through arrangements some of the time. But really good drummers like Jim Eno on this record are really active participants and play and write parts that are exactly what the song needs.
Oh, yeah.
And when
yeah.
that happens, I do think it really stands out. I mean, there's a lot of great drummers out there, of course, but I'm not just talking about technically good. I'm talking about people who really actively participate in the songwriting and the arrangement process. And so as we were talking about that and listening to that record, that particular track, it reminded me of who Jim Eno kind of reminds me of. Another unsung hero of the drums who always does the coolest possible thing for the song he's playing on and keeps amazing time. Yes, that's right, audience. I'm talking about Ringo.
That's it. That's that's what separates. The great drummers are all about the songs. They play, they do, they're the slave to the songs, and they add to the songs, and they do, and it's not about technique or technical ability. It's that, that's it. They're part of the songs, and it wouldn't be the same without them playing the song. Those are the great drummers for me.
Totally agree. Technique is overrated in not, it's important, but it's overrated in the sense that it does not do finish the job. What finishes the job is using the technique to do something really cool for that song.
Yep, that's it. All right, we're in total agreement. Let's see, we have this. Most of the songs are just credited to Britt Daniel, but this one, you've got a bunch of people on it, involved in it. It says to a little bit of Don't Let It Get You Down.
Outside and broke with them. She always said goodnight, knowing the wrong from right. But on the way the time, they showed the things she never thought. We left her down in the dumps. Whoa. All day and all of the night. Don't let
a real pretty song. I feel like this is one of the songs where I feel like it could be, it's just a good song and it could be done any number of ways, you know. Yeah. It's funny, as someone, I'm sure you also, that loves guitar and loves guitar in a record, you realize how little guitar there is. That little guitar flourish at the beginning is one of the like fanciest yeah. guitar on the whole record, right?
Yeah, it's true. It really stands out. Yeah, I think it's a nice song. I do think we're kind of in the doldrums of the record. I think all the record is pretty damn good, to be clear. But picking up on your comment, I like the song. I kind of think anyone could have done it. And I do think they're bordering on too much production-wise in the song. I think where so much of the rest of the record is so tight, so airy, maybe, you know, by adding those extra guitars and the pianos a little more in the front on this one too, I still think it's a success. And I do like the song. I like his falsetto melody lines that he does. But I don't know. If I had to pick a
you
low point, it would probably be this
too
one.
Much there.
Yeah, I'm just saying it stands out a little bit from the rest
right.
of the record. I still enjoyed
I
the song.
What you're saying.
And I forgot to complain. You know, I I couldn't come on your podcast and not complain a little bit.
Of
even
course
about
not, because
I
the
love.
Name of your podcast is 1001 Album Complaints. So yeah, you.
But I forgot to mention that someone something as a song title is pretty lazy, Britt. I mean, you could.
Oh, okay.
You could have probably, you know, done something there. No. I mean, I dig the song, and in fact, but the next song coming up is my sort of deep cut song that deserves more attention.
Oh, okay.
This sounds like a Spoon song. Don't let it get you down. It's fine. I don't really have anything bad to say about it, but it kind of just like meets the mark for me. It doesn't really exceed the mark.
And also, before we go to the next song, I want to mention real quick, he does throw a little Easter egg. I feel a Kinks Easter egg because he says all day and all the night in the song. And I feel like that's one thing we haven't mentioned, but that's also another reason why I think I thought they were British at first, is because much like the Kinks, they have these quirky little songs. And you know, I do see a sort of a kindred spirit between him and Ray Davies.
Walter, remember when the world was young and old? Knew Walter's name. Walter, isn't it a shame the way our little world has changed?
That's a good, that is a good touchstone for them, and I think some of the production touches, now that you're saying it, yeah, are calling back to, you know, Village Green Preservation Society, yes, type stuff. Yeah,
exactly,
that makes sense.
All right, cool. All right, but now we get, yeah, I totally agree with you with this next one. Let's listen to this. It's a great All the Pretty Girls Go to the City. Those toms in there too. If you were in the studio there, you'd be nodding your head going, yeah.
Heck yeah. Everything this band does makes me want to bob my head.
Right?
That's, you know, they pass that test with flying colors consistently. So even the stuff I might be complaining about. But yeah, I think this is great. I think the drums, the drum kit for once, gets a really nice showcase in this song. It starts with that little roll. We get the tom-toms, that kind of tribal feel. We get that shaker in there, yeah, like really nice drums. And, you know, something they're always good at, but I think is highlighted here, is that sense of syncopation, of space, again,
yes,
in the rhythm.
Right.
Yeah, just so cool. And, you know, it feels like a lot of what it means to be in the band Spoon is to sit around and wait for your time to play in the song. And you're just kind of like,
right,
you're just like holding your tambourine like, oh, is it time yet? Nope, it's not time yet, you know, just come in for a second.
Right.
But
right.
I think I laughed out loud when you were just playing it back, but that piano stab, whatever weird, you know, diminished chord that was, just kind of comes in the middle a couple times, like, burr,
yeah, right,
like a honk. Yeah, that's great.
It's great.
Another technique I want to call out on this song, though, is the call and response nature of the vocal and the piano. So, you know, when they have the piano part in the opening and they have the guitar part and they're doing a call and response thing with each other.
Oh, right.
And then the vocal
okay.
comes in and kind of picks up where the piano left off, and they continue this nice, like, there's a real lack of layering. A lot of production, a lot of, especially modern music, it's about starting with less and just adding. That's how you get dynamic change. You just keep adding stuff on top. And by the end, and I've been guilty of this, by the end, it's just every voice, every instrument, every part layered on top. And,
right.
and that can be cool, you know, but this is really the opposite of that. It really allows a part to happen and then go away, sometimes for a while.
Yeah. No, they're masters of subtraction, I would say. Definitely.
Subtraction, exactly. Yes.
There you go. All right, let's listen to the next one. A little bit of You Gotta Feel It. One thing I'm just realizing now is that they put a lot of the more heavier drum songs in the back of the record, and they started the record with the more sparse drums, which is also a really like brave thing to do.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's one of the reasons it feels like foreplay at the beginning. Maybe right. They're trying to ramp you into something that's progressively more groovy. I think this song works, but I also... If you told me that this is just something in the studio one day, Britt Daniel just started vamping and improvising what a Spoon song would be,
right.
And Jim Eno, the drummer, just joined him, and then they did that for 90 seconds and called it a song, I would believe that.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, it's barely a song. It's like 1 minute 29. So, yeah, it's...
right. So that's fine. I don't have a problem with it. Right. I'm just saying it sounds a bit like that, yeah.
Yep, I hear you. All right, but the last two songs of the record, I feel like really, and especially lyrically too, I think they're really interesting. Let's listen to song number 11, a little bit of Back to the Light. Again, for the rhythm, you have that acoustic, and then you got that nasty percussion sound. It reminds me of Tom Waits, like a Tom Waits hook song or something.
It's so funny. I was thinking that, because didn't Tom Waits famously have someone like destroying a chair for percussion?
Yes.
on some song. Yeah, so. it sounds like someone stomping on a pile of plywood or something like that. Yeah, no, it's great. It's, another interesting production. I was wondering, and what is that... kind of violin, you know, sound coming in. Is that just a synth? I didn't see any strings credited, but...
Yeah, who knows? Or it could just be some kind of keyboard thing. I don't know, but like I was saying, I like it goes, son, you must go back to the life. Go pack your bags, take up your scythe, because this world wasn't meant for us both. I like that because I don't know what the fuck he's singing about, but it sounds really like sort of ominous and interesting, you know?
Sure, yeah. Yeah,
I love stuff like that. I love how he doesn't. He's definitely not a story guy spelling things out for you type songwriter, which I appreciate. I also like the other kind. I love Dylan. You know, I love Bob Dylan, but I also love songwriting like this as well.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think it's very effective. And I know I've been saying a lot of the same words again and again, but economical, tight. It's weird because I have this idea in my head that this thing was recorded in this tiny room with two or three guys just kind of crammed in together. Like, it feels intimate. But at the same time, there's all these production touches that tell me there were a lot of overdubs and a lot of effects
put on
things. Right. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
but at the same time, the band sounds so tight in general that you're just picturing guys just staring right at each other, very close to each other.
Yes. Well, you know what? There's another great music podcast called Life of the Record, and I'd love to hear a Life of the Record episode of Spoon doing an album, one of their records, you know, this one or another one, because that's where the people involved in it just talk about the making of it, and that would be really interesting to me. I mean, I think that would be great. So there you go. Life of the Record, you put on notice. All right, so we get the final track. Really nice, sparse. You already mentioned the Beatles. It's funny. I feel like no matter what band I will ever talk about, the Beatles are going to get mentioned. But yeah, it kind of makes sense because the Beatles are sort of, you know, they sort of started it all in modern, you know, rock music as we know. You know, as we know it and we love it over the past 40-50 years, you can't say at some point it wasn't, you know, they weren't an influence, even if not directly, indirectly, right?
Of course, yeah. Well, I think they were the first band to really embrace the studio as an instrument concept, and they had access to a lot of the, at the time, new technology, and they were willing to get in and experiment, and so, yeah, clearly they've influenced so many people. And also because the songs they wrote and the productions they made shot off in so many different genre directions. They were also not afraid of bringing in other genres and trying things.
Right.
And that's important.
I think so. All right, so let's get the final song. Like I said, really nice, sparse song. Let's listen to Vittorio E. You know, it starts out, we didn't mention, we've talked about the production, but the fact that they left a lot of things in, they left a lot of, you know, studio noise and laughing, which makes it all feel organic. And this one really feels like, at first it seems like, oh, it's just him in the studio with playing and singing at the same time, and you hear the room,
right.
But then everything, and then the little bit of piano and everything, and the bass sort of creeps in, and it sort of sounds a little bit more like it's produced, a little bit more than being off the cuff, but it's really subtle.
It feels like an album closer, which I think is great. Yeah. I like when I listen to bands, especially modern ones, and it seems like they, through their sequencing and production choices, they have a good knowledge of the canon, you know, of what I believe is like the way to construct an album. And so this fits the bill there.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And you're talking about all the stuff they left in. One of the highest compliments I can pay this is it's a tight, meaning a short record. It's like 36 minutes long. This is in the CD era still, right?
Exactly.
Where people were making 80-minute records.
Oh, they're so bad because you could tell for sure there's like on those records, there's like three or four, you know, filler songs that wouldn't have been in there if it wasn't CDs.
Exactly. It's just basic theatricality. Leave me wanting more. You'd much rather leave me wanting more than the other thing, right?
Yep.
So I think it was great of them to keep it really economically timed, and in spite of that, they still leave like 3 minutes of non-song material on the tape. But you know what, the other thing that I think it applies kind of to all the songs or most of the songs, but I just thought of it, I think one of the hallmarks of this band is they really emphasize the upbeat. Everything is like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, okay.
And you can really hear that, and rarely do they emphasize the one and three, or yeah, or not the and yeah. beat. And you can hear it even in that acoustic guitar part, that he's emphasizing the upbeat.
Yes.
You know, and I think a lot of times, that's why when we maybe commented on one of the other songs where he had that kind of downstrokey guitar, traditional punk approach, it stands out. But I think even then, probably the bass is playing those upbeats, or the bass drum is playing the upbeats.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. And all right, so Rob, here's the question. I don't know, is Spoon at all in that 1001 records you got to hear before you die? Is it
not
on that list? They're not.
No, they're not. I know. I think it's an oversight. I think it's partly because they're an American phenomenon and partly because they're a newer phenomenon, of course, although the list has been updated a few times. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to come on your show and talk about them, is I do feel like they deserve a lot of credit. I'm not sure, to be fair, I'm not sure how influential they've been exactly on the rest of music, but I do think they're an example of a modern band who's putting a lot of care in every part of the process.
Right.
And is out there putting on amazing shows. I did see these guys, I think probably in 2005 or 6, on the Gimme Fiction tour at like a really small club.
Yep.
In San Francisco.
Me too. I think I saw them on that. I've seen them a couple times, and I think I saw them on that tour. They did a great for an encore. What did they cover? They covered Hateful by The Clash, which was great. And they were really good.
They're a really, really great band to see. I actually saw them last summer touring with Weezer.
Oh, nice.
At a big amphitheater. They were great there too. And, you know, so I think that I like to give almost extra credit to the modern rock bands who are still out there doing it.
Yeah.
Because it's not the coolest thing, right, at this time and place to be in a band like this. It's just not what's happening in pop music, like perhaps it was 40 years ago. So yeah, I think they deserve more attention and love.
Agreed. And all right, so final question. If they were on the list, and if you did bring it, do you think your other three, those co-host guys, those haters, would like this album? I think they probably would, right?
Well, I think they would too. They're also my oldest friends and old bandmates, and so we've all been listening to kind of similar music for a long time. And while I am probably the Spoon champion there, I think we've all been influenced by this band. We were all at some of those shows and in those cars that I mentioned today.
Right. Oh, okay.
And we used to cover some of these, or we covered a song, I think, from Girls Can Tell in one of my old bands. I remember that. But so I'm going to say yes.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So yeah, 1001 Record Complaints is on. I know I'm on an episode coming. I don't know. They may come out around the same times. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, you came over and did Manic Street Preachers with us, and that, oh man, if I have my dates up, that's due out in a couple weeks from when we're taping this, so yeah, they might come out around the same time.
Okay, cool. And,
a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was fun, and it was, thanks for coming on here, I appreciate it. Don't forget, everyone on Instagram and Facebook, you can follow me at that Rick Gummy High. On X, it's at TRGMH Podcast. You can email me at trgmh33@gmail.com. Most importantly, if you want to become a patron of the show, you can go to patreon.com/TRGMH, become a patron. I'd appreciate it. Rob, once again, thanks. I always love, you know, if I have a guest on, if I could have a guest on named Rob, I mean, how is that going to be bad, right?
Indeed.
So thanks again for coming on. Good luck with your podcast, and I'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
All right, I'm Rob Elba. This is That Record Got Me High. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Just for you, here's a love song, and it makes me glad to say it's been a lovely day and it's okay. It's okay.